Hi, and welcome to Guideposts. I'm your volunteer reader, Sandy Summers. Today, we will continue reading from the December-January 2026 issue of Guideposts magazine with the cover story, Room to Grow. Room to Grow. My house was cluttered with all the stuff I'd bought. Was my soul cluttered too? By Julia Ubenga, Kansas City, Kansas. Every morning I sit at my kitchen table with a cup of coffee and take a deep breath of gratitude. I look around at the open, airy spaces, the clean counters and floors. Even with a full house, Justin and I have five children. There's no mess, no clutter. Everything has breathing room, especially me. It's not because I'm an amazing housekeeper or a perfect wife and mom. I feel at peace because our house wasn't always like this. I wasn't always like this. It took getting rid of 75% of our belongings, and more important, letting go of what was cluttering my soul so I could clear space for God. I grew up in a small town, Pella, Iowa. My mom stayed home with my two brothers and me, and my dad worked in window sales. I had a great childhood. Faith and family were everything, but my parents didn't have the budget for extras. That's where my maternal grandmother came in. She called me her favorite granddaughter and spoiled me like crazy. "Is that my Julia Ann?" she'd say when she saw me. I'd squeal with delight as she handed me a new doll or toy. In my teens, we grew even closer. We'd stroll the mall for hours and Grandma would buy me special gifts. "Just making sure you don't want for anything," she said. Accumulating possessions made me feel secure and cared for. More stuff equaled more happiness. That mindset stayed with me when I went to college. Through the shopping trips were curtailed. My senior year at William Jewell College in Missouri, where I played on the softball team, I met Justin, another senior. He played baseball and we clicked. Like me, Justin was a big fan of faith and church. A few months after graduation, Grandma passed away. I was inconsolable, too hurt to turn to God. Instead, I hit the mall. I signed up for my first credit card. What my entry-level job couldn't cover, my credit card could. To numb my grief, I'd buy things Grandma would have wanted and linger in stores trying to catch a whiff of her favorite Elizabeth Taylor perfume. Shopping was a dopamine rush, a bandage for my broken heart. Justin and I got married 3 years after college. He had a demanding job in insurance, and I got my master's, then worked full-time as a speech pathologist. My dream, though, was to be a stay-at-home mom. We made good money, and once we had our first daughter, Eva, there was more to acquire. Baby clothes and gear, nursery furniture, toys. Just as I'd done while grieving Grandma, anytime I had intense feelings, frustration over work, anxiety about being a first-time mom, I buried them with spending. At church on Sundays, I was distracted by other women's outfits. I'd see things I thought I needed, a silky blouse, elegant earrings, a trendy purse. Then I'd spend the entire service thinking about how to find a good deal on a similar item. Sometimes we'd even go shopping after church. Our house exploded with stuff. "We've got a big credit card bill to pay," Justin said once. "Know what we spent online last month?" "I don't want to know," I said. The numbers gave me anxiety. That's why Justin took care of the bills. We kept making the minimum payments and buying more toys, more clothes, more everything. I took Ava to Walmart every week, and I loved seeing her eyes light up at the displays of new toys. 7 months after our second daughter, Elena, was born, I left my job to become a stay-at-home mom. My dream, yet instead of contentment, I felt distracted and overwhelmed. I couldn't seem to manage all the stuff in our home, no matter how hard I tried. I mentioned to my OBGYN that I was stressed, and he wrote me a prescription for an antidepressant, saying that I had postpartum depression. I didn't take the medication. Deep down, I knew my problem wasn't depression. Our debt, which had ballooned to $40,000, weighed on me. I spent to mask my anxiety, which led to more debt, more anxiety. A vicious cycle. I started seeing a therapist for my anxiety, but was too embarrassed to admit to her how much debt we had, and I was too ashamed to tell Justin how overwhelmed I felt. Most of all, I was too ashamed to talk to God. One morning while Eva was at preschool, I sat in the nursery feeding Elena. Sunlight streamed through the window, illuminating everything in the room. An unused crib filled to the brim with baby clothes. A jumble of plastic light-up toys. Rolls of wrapping paper. Justin's golf clubs in the corner. A tangled slinky. So much stuff. It set my nerves on edge. Instantly, I felt guilty. Why couldn't I just be happy? I had everything I'd ever wanted. A loving marriage, two beautiful daughters, this big house filled with nice things. But staring at the mess, I couldn't hold my feelings in. This isn't what I signed up for, I shouted, my voice echoing against the nursery walls. Something needs to change. I turned away from the chaos. That's when I spotted a Bible on the nightstand. I flipped it open. Something in Luke chapter 12 jumped out at me. Jesus told a crowd, one's life does not consist of possessions, then spoke of being rich in what matters to God. Did I even know what mattered to God? When had I last actually talked to him? Clearly, I had a lot to think about. 2 days later, I had another therapy appointment. I dropped off Eva at preschool and brought Elena with me, her diaper bag slung over my shoulder. I'm deep in debt and beyond overwhelmed, I confessed. I want a better life for our family. My therapist looked at the diaper bag, jam-packed with extra clothes, snacks, and toys. Julia, she said, have you ever heard of minimalism? Oh, like houses with stark white walls and nothing in them? It's more than that. Look into it. In the car, I Googled minimalism. If your possessions aren't used or loved, let them go, one article read. Minimalism is really about making room for God and realigning your heart with what matters. There it was again, what matters. I think we should try minimalism, I told Justin when he got home. You want to try what? He said with a laugh. Julia, you love shopping. I couldn't blame Justin for laughing. I hadn't been honest with him. I never brought this up because I was too ashamed. I said, you work so hard to provide us with nice things, but all our stuff is causing me horrible anxiety. I'm distracted from you, from the kids, from God. Justin was quiet for a moment. I see what you mean, he said. We've gotten caught up in a consumerism and let what's important fall away. If you want to give minimalism a go, I'm all in. I'd read that it was best to start off in a small place. The next day, I tackled the kitchen junk drawer. Here goes, I thought, pulling it open. Paper and sticky notes spilled out. Immediately, I wanted to hop on Amazon and click add to cart on something just to get a rush. No more stuff, I told myself. Little by little, I cleared that drawer, throwing away old receipts and flyers, putting pens in a holder on the counter. It felt good. But the thought of doing that to every space was paralyzing. Eva came up to me, her arms full of clothes, blankets, and costume jewelry. I handed her a small bag, and we went to her room. Some kids don't have any toys. Do you have anything you'd like to give them? She nodded and put stuffed animals and puzzles into a bag. Her room felt lighter. I did too. That gave me the momentum to declutter other rooms. If we didn't use an item, I put it in a donation bin. Over the next few weeks, the energy in the house shifted. I realized I hadn't gone shopping other than for groceries. It's so much calmer in here, Justin said, coming into the kitchen one morning to say goodbye before work. Our house was calmer, but something inside me still felt restless. Maybe I needed to work on my inner clutter too. Opening up to my therapist and my husband was a start. Where to go from here? Now that my kitchen table was clear, I had an idea. I sat down with a cup of coffee and imagined Jesus sitting right there across from me. Lord, I'm sorry I lost sight of you amid all the stuff, I prayed. Help me make more room for you in my home and in my heart. A verse I remembered from church came to mind. Genesis 28, verse 16. When Jacob awoke from his sleep, he thought, surely the Lord is in this place. And I was not aware of it. I'd been too busy burying my emotions and shopping to be aware of God's presence, surrounding myself with possessions so I could feel taken care of. Yet even when I turned away from him, God watched over me. I took a deep breath and said, thank you, Lord. Kitchen table chats with Jesus became my new morning routine. On Sundays, I listened to our pastor's sermon instead of checking out other women's outfits. Day by day, my desire to buy more gave way to gratefulness for what I already had. Over the course of a year, 75% of our possessions went packing, along with thousands of dollars of debt. 7 years later, we're still living minimally in a new, smaller home. That's why I take time every morning to look around and take a deep breath of gratitude. It reminds me that not only am I rich in what matters, but I also have room for what matters, for my husband, our children, and the one who truly takes care of all our needs. For more on this story, see Family Room. 5 tips for decluttering your home and your life. Change your mindset. It's hard to let go of possessions. After all, you've spent money and time on them. But really, everything we have comes from God. We are simply stewards. Give the Lord ownership of it. All the stuff you declutter and the stuff you'll keep. Start viewing possessions as transient objects like a bubble, fireworks or an ocean wave, something you observe and enjoy, then let go. The best time to start is now. What would your life be like with less stuff? Grab a laundry basket and walk through your main living spaces. Extend your arm over clutter areas such as counters and tops of furniture and sweep all the stuff into the basket. Continue until all surfaces are clutter-free. Sort through the basket while you're doing something enjoyable, listening to a podcast, watching a TV show. Can you breathe easier with less clutter? That's a reminder that you can live an abundant life without an abundance of stuff. Set a timer and devote 15 minutes each day to decluttering. That adds up to 7.5 hours a month and 90 hours a year. Over time, small, consistent efforts lead to big results. HALTS before you buy. HALTS stands for hungry, angry, lonely, tired, and sad, sick, stressed. The next time you're considering buying something, ask yourself, if I weren't lonely, tired, sad, etc., would I still buy them? If no, then don't buy it. If yes, wait 24 hours before purchasing to see if you still need it. Notice your habits and find a replacement behavior. Do you scroll Amazon when you're tired? Turn to a book or a journal instead. Do you click buy now when you're sad? Try calling a friend or going for a walk. Memories are found in you, not your possessions. Decluttering sentimental items can be a challenge. We're afraid we'll lose the memory attached to the object. Try what I call the spontaneous combustion method. Hold the item and ask yourself, if this were to spontaneously combust, how would I feel? If you'd feel relief, let it go. If you'd feel good, but a little guilty, take a picture of the item, then let it go. If you feel devastated, then keep it. Trust your memories to God. When you give Him control, it's much easier to loosen your grip. Free yourself from digital clutter. During a walk one night, I was checking my phone when a gentle voice stopped me. How can I connect with you when you're like that? I realized that I checked texts, email, and social media multiple times an hour. Now I leave my phone behind for short walks, turn off social media notifications, and even put my phone on do not disturb mode for hours at a time. We have more room for moments that matter and for God when our eyes aren't glued to phones. I'm Sandy Summers, and you're listening to Guideposts on Sun Sounds of Arizona, a 24-hour reading and information service for people who can't read print due to a disability. If you missed any part of this program, you may access it anytime on demand at www.sunsounds.org. In addition to the bi-monthly Guideposts magazine, each week we may be reading some of Guideposts' other daily devotions or inspiring stories from Guideposts online. Personal best. How could I ever live up to Papa's example? Our old rugged cross by Michael Floyd Thompson, Edmond, Oklahoma. 2 weeks before Christmas, I walked around our front lawn and around to the east side of our house. There it was, unceremoniously propped against the brick exterior, the 6-foot-tall cross that my late Papa, my maternal grandfather, Sherman Floyd, had constructed and given me 22 years earlier. How had I let it fall into such disrepair, with one arm cracked and broken off? I stared guiltily at the cross. I'd wanted to restore it and return it to its place of honor in front of our house at Christmas, festooned in white lights. And I had tried over the years, trying to fix it with nails, wood, glue, rope, even duct tape. Nothing worked. Because the problem was me. I was no handyman or carpenter. I wasn't good with tools like Papa. Never had been. So I'd given up and tucked the damaged cross away at the side of the house where it wouldn't stare me in the face, reminding me of how I couldn't hope to accomplish anything close to what Papa had. I would have let the cross be, but then Mama Papa's widow, had come to live with my wife Stephanie and me. This past summer, the last of Mama's three children had died, and ever since, my 96-year-old grandmother hadn't been her usual upbeat self. When I pulled out the holiday decorations from the attic after Thanksgiving, we asked Mama if she wanted to set up a little tabletop tree in her sitting room like before. "I don't think I want to decorate this year," Mama said. "It doesn't feel like Christmas." "Not decorate?" Mama and Papa used to go all out for Christmas. They made their house in my hometown of Porto, Oklahoma, festive with Santa and nutcracker figurines, several nativities, and a towering tree in their living room. The pillars on their front porch were wrapped with red velvet ribbons to look like candy canes. Greenery framed each windowsill. Lights outlined the eaves, and a wreath graced the front door. But all of this was secondary to what Papa called the old rugged cross. He made it by hand and would put it up in the front yard wrapped in white lights. It was much more than a decoration to him and Mama. The cross was a statement of their faith. Stephanie and I got engaged the Christmas of 2001, and we drove out to Porto so she could meet my grandparents. We had a wonderful visit, and as we were leaving, Papa said, "Stephanie, you know why we have a cross in the yard at Christmas?" Although I heard his answer dozens of times growing up, I waited for it. "That cross symbolizes the Savior," Papa said. "Without his crucifixion, his birth wouldn't matter." A member of the greatest generation, Papa was a lot like that old rugged cross, weathered and worn, yet steadfast and resilient. He joined the Army Corps during World War II and served as a flight engineer in the China-Burma-India Theater, flying dangerous missions over the Himalayas. He came home to Oklahoma, married, finished college, and became a history teacher and the head football coach at Porto High School, leading the team to state playoffs multiple times. He led the school as principal from 1972 until his retirement in 1986, and he served on the city council. Long after he left teaching and coaching, people would come up and thank him for the impact he'd had on their lives. Everyone admired Sherman Floyd. In my eyes, there was nothing my grandfather couldn't do. He'd even tripled the size of the one-bedroom bath house that he and Mama had bought when they came to Porto, building a comfortable home for their family of five. He'd done everything with his own two hands, the framing, electrical, and plumbing. Given how skilled Papa was, I shouldn't have been surprised at the gift he delivered to Stephanie and me in 2002 for our first Christmas as a married couple. But I was surprised and deeply moved. He presented us with a 6-foot cross built with as much care as his own. Papa crafted it from two landscape timbers, cutting notches with a circular saw to make them fit together perfectly in the center. He secured the cross with a long railroad nail that he'd managed to pound completely into the thick wood, then wrapped it in white lights. It stood tall on our front lawn, a testament to how faith and family intersected in our lives. I couldn't help feeling like it was Papa's stamp of approval on the man I'd become. Maybe that's why, even after the railroad nail came loose and the cross fell apart and resisted all my efforts to put it back together, I still couldn't bring myself to get rid of it. I'd stowed it at the side of our house where it had stayed for the past 10 years or so. But I couldn't leave it like that anymore, not with Mama saying she didn't feel up to celebrating Christmas. She had lifted my spirits after my mom, her oldest child, died of cancer when I was 20. Now it felt as if the Lord was charging me with doing the same for her. I laid the cross flat on the lawn and knelt to examine the pieces of the broken arm. The wood had cracked so badly, there was no way to reattach the arm. Yet I didn't want to replace the timber altogether. It felt important to keep the wood Papa had used. I wish he were here to guide me. It always gave me a boost to see Papa on the sidelines at my high school wrestling matches and football games. Even though he had long retired from coaching by then, he didn't just sit in the stands. He cheered me on from up close. "Give it your best, Michael," he used to say. "Never give up." Had I truly given the task of repairing this cross my best, or had I let my insecurities about my lack of carpentry skills get the best of me, to the point that I'd never even brought the problem to God? Right there, kneeling on the lawn, next to that old rugged cross, I prayed, "God, I'm not the handyman Papa was, so I need you to show me how to resurrect this cross, for Mama's sake. That night after dinner, when Mama was settled in her room watching TV, I told Stephanie what I was up to. If you prayed about this, I know you're serious, she said, giving me a hug. First, I went on a line and ordered 2 strands of white lights for next day delivery. Then I watched a bunch of DIY videos on wood repair. Maybe if I glued the original pieces to a solid new piece of wood and attached it to the back of the cross, that would be enough to brace the horizontal beam. The next day, I measured each piece of the cross and took pictures with my cell phone. I'm going to the hardware store, I texted Stephanie, trying to keep my secret from Mama. I think I figured out a solution, she replied with a praying hands emoji. I explained my idea to the hardware guy. Sure, that'll work, he said. He cut a 2x4 that spanned the length of both arms of the cross, then showed me long nails and wood glue he thought would do the job. Back home, I spread everything out on the driveway. I turned the cross over and nailed the 2x4 to the back of the horizontal beam. As carefully as I tried to work, I hit my thumb with the hammer. Got a splinter in my finger, bent 2 nails, and had to pry them out. God, I prayed, help me do this. At last, the brace was done. I glued the broken pieces to it. I dug a hole in the front yard and planted the wood cross. I pounded dirt hard around the base and stepped back. The cross stood tall, its arms stretched wide. A delivery driver arrived with the lights I'd ordered. I wrapped them around the cross and attached an extension cord. At dusk, I found Stephanie in the kitchen and Mama in her sitting room. Come outside, I said, trying to play it cool. They followed me out to the driveway. I plugged in the extension cord. Mama gasped, Papa's cross. It glowed in the twilight, as beautiful as ever. Stephanie slid her arm around my waist, my handyman. What a wonderful Christmas present, Mama said. Papa would be so proud. I gazed at our old rugged cross and nodded. I thought I'd restored it for Mama, but I needed it too. I needed to know that even if I wasn't exactly the man Papa was, we were alike when it came to what was most important, showing our faith and doing our best for the ones we love. For more on this story, see Family Room. Faith and living. Why was it that the more I asked for God's help, the more I worried? Sheltered by Raylene Nickel, Keith, North Dakota. I was exhausted, but I couldn't go back to sleep. In bed with blankets piled on me, I listened for the sound of my big propane furnace kicking on. Please, Lord, let it work. It was January on my 400-acre North Dakota farm, and winter was in full swing. In the night, the temperature had dropped to 34 below zero. What a time for my furnace to be on the fritz. It hadn't been working right for 2 months during which I worried constantly, prayed intensely, had service technicians out multiple times, all to no avail. The furnace would light, making that reassuring, deep-throated hum, only to snap off. Then moments later, it would try again. So far after the second try, the furnace would stay lit. But how long before it gave out completely? I didn't want to think about the expense of buying a new one. I launched into what had become my nightly prayer, Father, strength for the furnace, healing, angels all around. It might sound strange to ask for healing for a furnace, but that's how worried I was about it. Right on cue, the furnace lit and then fell silent. I sat bolt upright listening. The furnace tried again, and this time succeeded. Still, there was no chance of my going back to sleep. This worry was driving me crazy. I got out of bed, switched on my wall electric heaters, and made some coffee. The electric heaters were lifesavers, but they couldn't keep the house nearly as warm as the furnace. Why wouldn't God just fix this? I sat in my big soft chair in the dining room, coffee cup in hand, and prayed again. Father, please heal the furnace. You can do anything. This is your farm, your house. If you have a role to play, show me what it is. Since my husband John's death 12 years ago, I had more intentionally taken God as my partner. I prayed about my farm, the care of my cattle and goats, my health, my work as a freelance agricultural journalist, my interactions with people, God's use of me in the world. I prayed to see problems through his eyes. I was used to bringing everything to God, every task, every brief trip to town or visit to a friend. But as I sip my coffee in the darkness of early morning, pondering the aggravating furnace, I began to see that fear had taken root in my prayers and in me. I was terrified of the furnace breaking down. It wasn't just the furnace. I feared getting a flat tire while driving to town. I feared the pump in the well quitting. I feared my cows having trouble delivering their calves. And my fear for those I prayed grew. When my sister told me about a young neighbor having a health crisis, I jumped to pray for him. But I agonized for his family, imagining their farm floundering as a result. Another neighbor continued to struggle with an illness he'd had for years. I prayed for him with so much hope in the beginning, then stopped discouraged. Just recently, I started praying for him again, but with a heavy heart. The act of prayer seemed to weigh me down. Where had my hope and sense of expectancy gone? As the dawn began to dissolve the darkness of the night, I asked, "Father, where are you in all these seemingly unanswered prayers? It feels as if you have not heard my prayers, that the skies are indeed made of impenetrable bronze." Nothing changed for a few days. The furnace continued being its erratic self, and I continued feeling that my prayers were overlooked. Then one bitterly cold morning, I was north of the farmyard inspecting the cow's feed supply of big round bales when I happened to look across the fields to the west. Out in the open, beyond the boundaries of my farm, a stiff breeze blew the snow in low waves across the ground, like shifting sand. Yet on my field, there was no moving snow. A row of trees John had planted years ago sheltered the farm from the wind. Planting prayers is like planting trees. Where did that idea come from? Yet in the next instant, I knew God was using a concept familiar to me to answer my own questions. John and I had been fanatical about planting trees, mostly for this very purpose, to provide shelter from the wind. It had not been easy. It was often fraught with failure, but we persisted. One time I had planted 40 pines alone while John was away helping a neighbor. The trees were meant to fill a gap in an old shelter belt that permitted wind and blowing snow to threaten livestock in the farmyard. I found the ground so hard and dry I could barely dig the holes. I broke down in tears, but I kept scraping at the hardened earth with my shovel until I at last got all the pines planted. That's all the time we have today for Guideposts. Thank you for listening. My name is Sandy Summers. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.